Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Barrow's tent village near Lewis recently closed for the winter and is now eyeing upgrades for next year.
We used recreational tents this season and they didn't prove to be viable for 5 months. And then next season we'll open in March and we'll continue for November. So we need more of a FEMA quality, military grade tents.
We speak with Barrow's executive director, Mike Agnew, about how this season went and future plans. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about tenant rights in the state of Delaware. Arts Playlist visits with the artist behind the latest exhibition at the Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington. And Enlighten Me offers strategies on how to find real happiness this holiday season. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Tharros Tent Village, or Camp Tharros, near Lewis, recently closed for the winter as Code Purple shelters opened to serve those facing homelessness in the area. Tharros reopened again this year after a delayed start, welcoming just under 30 total guests over the course of this year's warm weather season. Tharros is a temporary tent city for working people experiencing homelessness that was initially set up along Route 1 in the fall of 2024. Now it's becoming a recurring fixture. This week, Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale sits down with Mike Agnew, executive director of the Tharros Tent Village and partner of St. Jude Code Purple, to discuss the village project and what they have planned for next year.
So why don't we just start? Why don't you just tell us what Tharros is?
Tharros Village is a fair weather camp that'll be open in March, March 16th. So it's blended with Code Purple at the Cape. So we have two shelters here in the Cape region, one for men and one for women. We have 14 beds in each shelter. And Tharros opens when Code Purple closes in March. And then Tharros closes when Code Purple opens in December. So December 1st, which was Monday, Tharros closed and all our guests moved indoors to our Code Purple at the Cape shelter. So they complement each other. It's not as if we closed for some other reason. It was planned to be closed. Our guest residents knew it was going to close and it closed on time. And we have a lot of agreements with a conditional use ordinance with the county, with Sussex County, and we have a contract with the state of Delaware. So we're regulated basically. We have requirements, and that part of that was being open from March 16th to November 30th.
Your regulations there. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about that too?
Well, we have use of the property from the dates I gave you, and we're limited to 28 tents, which is also sort of a magical number. It's the two shelters. We have 14 beds in each shelter, but also the physical layout of the village limits us to 28. So the village is about a half an acre, and the tents are 10 feet apart for safety and fire reasons. And so we can only fit about 28. It's only viable for about 28 tents. There's one person to each tent. The residents that are interested in coming in have to apply to come in. They have to pass an application process. We have an admissions team that reviews their application, and not everyone that applies is accepted. I think we had 58 applications in the last season, and only 33 were actually accepted into the village. Coming into the village, they're required to work. There's no sitting around. So if they're not working, then we give them a volunteer assignment. And we have many volunteer assignments up and down Coastal Highway between Lewis and Rehoboth Beach and the unincorporated areas between there. A lot of the thrift shops take volunteers, and we send our guests there to volunteer. We also had volunteer opportunities with the streets department in Rehoboth Beach, cleaning up the boardwalk each morning throughout the season. And some of our guests that might not have worked recently, that might not be able to just go out and get in a job right away, were able to get these volunteer positions, which allowed them to build a resume and eventually get a job. And in some cases, our volunteer team members were actually hired. So yeah, they have to either work or volunteer. That's number one. Number two, they need to participate in case management. So we get case management from First Aid Community Action, which is a statewide organization that provides a number of services, case management being one of them. And our case manager's on site every Tuesday. Our guests are required to meet with their case managers at least once a month physically and once a month virtually, and accomplish the goals that are established by the case manager. And those goals could vary from rebuilding relationships with family members, friends, finding a job, getting their health insurance in order, getting their identification papers in order. There's a number of different things. It varies by person. All of our residents have to be willing to work. There's no alcohol or drugs permitted in the village. Anyone with an alcohol problem or a drug problem has to go to rehabilitation. We have a sort of an agreement with Banyan up in Milford. They've taken a number of our guests over this past season, where the guests will spend 30 days in detox. And when they come back, they're required to participate in AA programs at least twice a week. So there's no tolerance at all. And not everyone in the homeless community is attracted to that kind of effort. So the benefit, of course, is that they get treated with dignity. They have a clean place, a safe place to live, that they're there legally. They're not squatting. Should there be any disturbance in the village, they're welcome to call the police, and the police will come and resolve the issue, and they won't be affected at all, which is not normal for an encampment of homeless people. They have toilets, they have trash facilities, they have showers a couple of times a week. We bring a shower facility in for them. There's meals available at least once a day. And of course, they're at work most of the day. So there's plenty of food available in a cooler on campus under a canopy area, a sort of a mess area for our guests. We have lots of volunteers that come by and check on our guests throughout the day. DSP is there a couple of times a day to check on our guests as well, should there be any issues that need to be addressed. That's kind of how it works. We did peak out at 28 guests at one point throughout the summer, but we weren't always at the 28, sometimes less. We closed on November 30th.
Plus or minus 28 people most of the season. I did want to ask, now that this first sort of deal is over, for now, obviously, how'd it go? How do you feel like it went this time?
Yeah, I think it went really well. We don't have the amenities at the level I think that we would like. We don't have electricity, for example. We're looking to install that over the next 3 months, so we can open up in the spring with electric power, lights, for example, after sundown. We did have running water. We had a plumber come in and install running water, so we had water. We don't have showers or laundry facilities there yet, but that's something that we're looking at on the long term. For next year, we're looking to improve our camera facilities, also improve the quality of our tents. We used recreational tents this season, and that they didn't prove to be viable for 5 months. And then next season, we'll open in March and continue till November. So we need a more of a FEMA quality, a military grade tent. So we'll be improving that for the opening in March as well. So we have a number of projects that were already on the books that we're looking at. And we're also discussing this with several donors in the area that can contribute the funds necessary to reopen with the amenities that we need. I think the enforcement of the work requirement every day can become difficult on the volunteers. We do have a bus, so we transport our guests as best we can from and to their volunteer assignments or their employment. If it's convenient to the coastal highway, try to stay along coastal highway with the bus as much as possible. But we have some costs involved. There's certainly a cost involved in running our bus. It's a couple of $1,000 a month just in gas and maintenance to run the bus. But we think the benefit's there. I think taking the real benefit, I think, of the Theros Village is removing people from the encampment, which immediately allows partner organizations like BB Healthcare to come in and address all of the chronic illnesses that we have among the homeless or unsheltered community, rather than having those being addressed at the ER, which saves a lot of money for the community. Think about fire, ambulance, and police, as well as the cost of healthcare at our BB facility. So that's a real plus. Creating a clean environment for the people who want to get out of the homeless situation that they're in is a positive in and of itself. So when Governor Meyer says, "I want to reduce homelessness in the state of Delaware by 50%," I was speaking to Matt Heckles, the Secretary of Housing, recently, and I said, "Well, what 50% do you want to reduce?" Because there's a population within the population of homeless people that really want to get out of it, that are really intent on not staying. I'm homeless, but I'm not staying homeless. There's another population within the population of, I'll say, chronic homeless that don't want to get out, that are comfortable in enjoying the charitable offerings of the community around them, and aren't really interested in actually moving forward. And then we have homeless tourists that are just passing through. So we try to filter out those last two for the Theros Village. We don't really filter them out for our Code Purple shelters in the wintertime because it's cold. Everyone deserves to get out of the cold, regardless of their intent. But Theros is a bar above, so it requires a little bit more. And it's not just, you don't just walk in. You have to be ready to come in, and you have to be really willing to go to work. And I don't just mean in employment, but make the effort to climb out of the situation that you're in. We've seen a year on year from 23 to 24 at our indoor shelters. We average 22 guests here in the Lewis Rehoboth Beach area. In 24, 25, that number rose by 50% to 33 guests each night. So we're not going to solve homelessness, but I think we can make a dent in it and help control the growth of it.
Thanks to Mike Agnew, Executive Director of the Theros Tent Village, and our Israel Hale for joining us on The Green this week. Next up on The Green, we learn more about tenant rights in the First State. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The home ownership rate in Delaware decreased by 3% over the past decade, from 74% to 71% as of 2023. And that's still higher than the national rate, which sits at 64%. So about a quarter of the state's housing units are occupied by renters. There are state and municipal laws to protect renters, but sometimes it's difficult to dissect those rules. Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee recently sat down with the Community Legal Aid Society's Deputy Director, Sarah Spangler-Rhine, to go over tenant rights in Delaware.
In Delaware, eviction filings have declined. From 2019, where we had 7,749 evictions filed, in 2024, we only had 11,400 filed. So that doesn't mean that evictions aren't happening. However, we still have a pretty high per capita eviction rate. And early intervention into eviction is really, really important. So what I mean by early intervention is if you get a letter from your landlord saying that you violated any portion of your lease, or if you get a letter from your landlord saying that you haven't paid any portion of your rent, you should immediately be communicating with your landlord. And if you are unable to do that, you should immediately be reaching out to legal services to see if you qualify for the right to representation. That's a statutory right that provides tenants facing eviction with the right to have someone with them through the eviction process. You can go to delegalhelplink.org and fill out an online intake. If you are not eligible for free legal assistance, reaching out is also a good idea because you may be able to get directed to other resources that are available to you.
I figured I would structure our conversation going in order of becoming or being a tenant. So from when you're touring a place to rent to moving out, essentially. Starting at the beginning, can you tell me a little bit about what folks should look out for when they're touring or looking at a lease, even for red flags that they need to look out for?
First, you know, there are a number of housing search tools in the state for affordable housing and for housing that is available. I would advise folks to use reputable sources. And, you know, if someone is offering you housing through a non-reputable source like Facebook or, you know, eBay or something, that you make sure that you see the property and meet the landlord before signing a lease or giving anybody any money. Also, you should know that when you apply for housing, you can be asked to pay for the application, and there is no guarantee that the landlord will process that application. All leases are contracts between a landlord and a tenant, so most leases include rules or promises that a tenant must make. You know, some examples would be, you know, a promise not to disturb your neighbors, a promise not to do things without the landlord's permission. A landlord-tenant code also has rules that a landlord must follow as part of a lease, and that's, you know, the promise to keep the property clean and safe and the promise not to damage or destroy the property. You should read a lease before you sign it. If there's anything in the lease that seems wrong, you should ask the landlord about it or consult a reputable source. So I might say this a few times during this conversation, but ChatGPT and Google are often wrong about Delaware law. Those are not the places that you should go for information. You should go to the JP Courts website or the Delaware Courts website or one of the legal aid organization websites, or you can call legal aid organizations for assistance if you have questions about the legality of the lease that you're signing.
And how can someone considering signing a lease check that their place is up to code?
Yeah, so every individual jurisdiction in Delaware has different rules about how a landlord must register the property with the locality. So you can contact your locality to inquire about the property. You can also do a property search to ensure that, you know, the person that says that they own the property does in fact own the property, and to see how long they've owned that property. Also, just again, you know, you should ask the landlord to walk through a property before you sign a lease.
The next step is moving in. I understand that Delaware law says landlords have a duty to keep their units safe and clean. Can you talk a little bit about the requirements there and what people should be able to expect from their landlords?
Landlords are responsible for, as you said, for keeping the unit safe and clean. They're also responsible for ensuring that essential services are provided. So that would be heat, hot water, water, electricity. Of course, the tenant may be responsible for paying the bills for those items, but the landlord has to ensure that those things are available on the property. You should make sure that in the lease you understand what utilities are and aren't included in your rent payment and what appliances aren't and aren't included. So if the property comes equipped with, say, a washer, a dryer, a refrigerator, a stove, all of those things need to be maintained in working order by the landlord. As a tenant, you're responsible for ensuring that the property is well kept, right? So keeping it clean, making minor repairs, and by that I mean like very minor repairs on your own that the landlord might not need to be called for, like replacing a light bulb. Landlords are responsible for providing maintenance in the properties that are rented by individuals. There can be a maintenance fee. Again, you'd reference your lease to determine if there's a maintenance fee. When you call your landlord to request maintenance, the landlord then can access your unit without giving you 48 hours of notice. So they could show up and knock on the door and ask to provide maintenance. Also important that maintenance can include treatment for infestation. So if you have, either rodents or cockroaches or other infestation that the landlord can, that can be reported to the landlord and they can show up and provide that service.
What should a tenant do if they've asked for something to be fixed, like heat, electric, water, cooling in the summer, but it's still not up to working order and some time has passed?
This is one of the most important things that I will say ever, and that is that if you have a problem, particularly with an essential service in your home, like heat, hot water, electricity, you should immediately put that in writing to your landlord. And depending on the severity of the issue, the landlord has a very short amount of time to make those repairs. So, you know, you should not be living in a house without heat or hot water or electricity. If the landlord fails to make those repairs, the landlord-tenant code provides for either termination of the lease or withholding of 2/3 of your rental amount. I would caution people against doing this without some legal advice because it's a hard, the ability to navigate that part of the landlord-tenant code is difficult. I would underline and highlight and put exclamation points beside the fact that you may not simply withhold your rent to your landlord if there is a problem with utilities or there's a problem with the conditions of the home. There is a new regulation that a gas or utility company cannot shut off service for non-payment during certain periods of the year. And if it's under 35 degrees. And so as we're going into what I suspect is going to be a very cold winter, I would like folks to know that between December 21st and January 1st, no utility shutoffs can happen. And from November 1st to March 31st, the utility shutoff cannot happen if the temperature is under 35 degrees. In addition, if your utilities are going to be turned off, the utility company must give you 14 calendar days notice before the utilities are turned off. So if you have the need for utilities because you have a medical issue, you can seek a medical exemption from your utility companies.
How should renters submit requests in writing? Does a text count? Should it be a letter?
Oh, man, that's a $1 million question. So the best legal advice is that you should always put things in writing in a letter and send it to your landlord's certified mail and keep a copy of that notice. However, certainly if you wake up in the morning and your house is 20 degrees because there's no heat, a text message to the landlord immediately shows that you're providing the landlord with notice, and so you should absolutely do that immediately. If you follow up in writing with a letter sent by certified mail, that's even better. But anything in writing, I think, in a situation where there's an emergent need is the most important, right, to get the information to the landlord quickly.
If you've put something in writing and you've requested that services be done, but a necessary utility, let's say, is out and it's not addressed, we're talking extreme circumstances. Let's say it's been like 4 days. It's the dead of winter, no heat. What's the next step?
Yeah, so if more than 48 hours have passed, you should follow up with your landlord in writing and say, you know, this problem continues. It has not been fixed. You may immediately terminate your rental agreement. If you get to the middle of your lease term and you don't have heat in your house, our laws provide you with the right to terminate your lease. So if you have somewhere else to go and you just want to move out, you could do that. Or, again, following up with written notice to the landlord, and best practice would be a letter sent by certified mail. You can keep 2/3 of your rent every day that hot water, heat, water, electricity are not provided to you, or if the landlord doesn't provide you with substitute housing. And again, I would really suggest that folks seek legal assistance if they do not have heat, hot water, electricity for more than a few hours.
Thanks to Classy's Deputy Director, Sarah Spangler-Ryan, and our Abigail Lee for joining us on The Green this week. Next on The Green, Arts Playlist, where we learn about the latest exhibition at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery and the artist behind it. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The work of Delaware-born artist Renita Corsi melds the traditional crafting of her native Nanticoke tribe with the style of vintage streetwear. Her art, including intricate beadwork, is on display this month at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Corsi joins Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny to chat about her work, the importance of community and tradition, and her journey as an artist.
You've got a really fascinating background. So I wonder if you can start by just talking about your background and kind of your journey as an artist.
Yeah, so my background, my mother is German and a little bit Irish, and my father's family are descendants of the Nanticoke tribe based out of Sussex County, Delaware. Millsboro was my hometown. And we lived in Millsboro until I was 11. And then we moved to Southeastern Virginia. And so from there, I joined the Navy. I served as a hospital corpsman for 4 years. And I served in San Antonio, Texas, and San Diego, Norfolk, Virginia, then finished out in Hawaii. And then that's why I decided to go to college in Hawaii. I earned a bachelor's degree in animal sciences with a pre-vet concentration. Got accepted into Washington State as a veterinary college, and then I got pregnant with my son shortly after. So I decided to forego that opportunity and raise my son and plant some roots back in Delaware, my home state. So that's what brought me back here. And so coming back to Delaware was big for me in that I reconnected with a lot of childhood friends that I had known before we moved. And then subsequently just reconnecting with the tribe, getting involved in the powwows, getting involved in learning beadwork. It just kind of all snowballed into one another, you know, and it kind of led me to get inspired to create my own brand, which is called the Nanticoke Native. It's kind of in my mind, its goal is to become like a collaborative brand with other Native creators, other people who are motivated by the same things I'm motivated by, specifically in their state and in our tribe, would be awesome. But any Native, you know, owned or led brand would be amazing to collaborate with. And so right now the tag, you know, is modern streetwear meets Native traditional, or Native traditional meets modern streetwear. And that's kind of my vision. But pushing beyond those boundaries, I kind of want to get involved in regalia construction, learning how to make like traditional regalia, fancy jingle dresses, things like that is what I'm interested in, as well as like showing my love for thrifted finds. You know, I like my stuff a little haunted. And so combining Native traditional with vintage streetwear is really cool as well. So I'm kind of interested. I got my hands in a lot of pots with that. kind of interested in doing a lot of things. But for right now, I'm just getting started. I've done beadwork since about 2022. Started prepping and purchasing materials in 2021, shortly after I had my son, and then actually started in 2022. And so it just kind of grew from there. And so now I would say I'm pretty proficient in two needle flat stitch, which is kind of like your basic, you know, flat beadwork that you see on, you know, on anything, whether it be a medallion or a moccasin or anything like that.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the process of creating beadwork, whether it's traditional or more modern influenced. What does it take to start from scratch and put a piece together?
A lot of it is just the design. That's the hardest part. Once you get your design down, if you have a picture in your head of what you want to do, or you're inspired by something somebody has done and you want to do that, a lot of it is prep work. So materials, gathering materials. And so for me, it's important to have materials that you can't just get at Michael's, you know, down the road, or Joann's, you know, before it closed. So a lot of that is shipping times that we have to work with, because I source a lot of my beads out of India. And then hides as well. A lot of Native artwork is, of course, backed by moose hide, buffalo hide, brain tan deer hide. So you have to source those out. And I try my best to purchase from Native companies, you know, on Etsy, or, you know, Cooley Dam Washington is a big one for me. Tribal Spirit Drums, Northland Visions out of Minnesota. Those are big ones that I purchase from. So a lot of it is material gathering, and then it's a lot of sketching, which I'm, art is not something that came naturally to me as a kid. It's like a muscle that you have to exercise just like anything else. And so it's a lot of sketching, it's a lot of color combinations, what works, what doesn't work, substituting out last minute and just kind of letting it flow from there. That's what works for me.
As I was getting ready to talk to you, as I was preparing for this interview, I found a line that really stood out to me in one of the things I read, talking about how for your work, tradition and innovation live side by side. And I wonder how they coexist, how they interact, how they get along, or maybe sometimes don't get along in your work.
That's interesting. Yeah. I think that it can go both ways. I agree. Especially when it comes to regalia making, we cling to tradition, from what I understand. I've never made a full set myself, but there's not a lot of straying from what used to be. And I feel like it should be that way. We should try to keep the regalia construction as traditional as possible and not branch out. But I like to play and push boundaries with, okay, what would it look like if outside of the powwow circle, of course, I made a pair of beaded moccasins that look like Nikes, like that had like a Nikes check mark, and that would be pretty fly in my opinion. You know what I mean? Like to have my son walking around with like some like Jordan 1s beaded mocs, like that would. And you see it today, like a lot of native brands are partnering with these big, like Bee Yellowtail out of Montana. She just partnered with Carhartt and is designing a whole line, designed a whole line for them. So we're seeing these native traditional styles in these modern streetwear already. It's happening. It's already happening, and I think it's one of the coolest things.
The works in this collection at the mezzanine are all inspired by people who are important to you. I wonder if you could tell me about one or two of the people that you're honoring in this work.
My children, for sure. First and foremost, Sage and Sunny. I'm such a better person now than before I had them and before I got to meet them. So I have to dedicate, and several pieces are in dedication to my children. In the exhibit, it consists of 10 pieces total, and two or three of those are for my children. And then I have to shout out and mention, James Johnson. We called him Uncle Mook. He's one of those uncles that, wasn't a family uncle, but was an uncle, still. And he passed away a few years ago. He was, without a doubt, one of the best creative minds I have ever met, in that he was a free thinker. He said anything he wanted to say, but he said it with tact, which is not an easy thing to do. And he was, without a doubt, also one of the funniest people I've met. So I had to honor him and his wife by creating a piece that reminded me that not everything's perfect, right? Because I wasn't happy with the piece in its entirety when I finished it. And so I was like, oh, I'll just keep this, as part of my, collection that I'll keep and look back on. And then my daughter, thought it was a good idea to throw the two pieces in the bathtub, one day. And I reflected on it, because deer hide and water are not entirely friendly with one another. So I thought about it, and I said, you know what, this is perfect, because my Uncle Mook had a saying that we all remember, anybody who spent time with him, and he said, everybody's got roaches, right? And that was his way of saying, nothing's perfect. Nothing's going to be perfect. Nobody is perfect, and everybody's got their own thing going on. And so I titled the piece, Everybody's Got Roaches, because one, it honored him. Two, it reminded me that the piece, albeit not perfect, is good enough. And he was definitely one of the people in my garden that I'll remember forever. And his smart mouth made the world feel a whole lot lighter.
One of the things that stands out to me in talking to you is the humility and the sense of community that you bring to your art, that you're part of something larger and being very mindful of that. I wonder if you could just sort of reflect and expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. It comes so naturally to me, to include people who are important to me in whatever I do, you know, whether it be work or I don't know. I feel it is a part of who I am, you know, to naturally want to honor or respect or shine a light on somebody who either inspired me or that it just comes so naturally, whether it comes to people who I grew up with or people who I love now, you know, my children or my best friends. Like I title some of my earrings after my coworkers, you know, who like mean a lot to me. It's just, it comes so naturally to want to shine a light on that, as well as remind me that it's bigger than me. You know what I mean? Like it's bigger than like, I don't want it to be all about me, you know, and what I want it to be about things that are important to me, which are people, you know, people that I love, concepts that I love, sayings that I love, just so effortless, you know.
Thanks to Delaware artist Renita Corsi and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. Corsi's work is on display this month at the Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington's Carville State Building. For more information on the exhibition, visit arts.delaware.gov. More of Corsi's work is online at nanticokenative.com. And for a deeper conversation, listen to this story online at delawarepublic.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where a University of Delaware professor offers advice on how to make your holiday season truly happy. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Holiday happiness might seem easy, but that's not always the reality. Many can struggle finding the joy expected during the holiday season. While receiving gifts can be great, true happiness during this time of year is often found in giving to others. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry sits down with University of Delaware Lerner College of Business and Economics Assistant Professor of Marketing Amit Kumar to discuss strategies for finding happiness during the holidays.
The holidays, as the song says, it's the most wonderful time of the year, and it's a time that should bring happiness and joy. But for many, it doesn't. Why is that?
I think sometimes just the nature of the holidays can make us forget about what we're celebrating in the first place, which is other people. Other people are a huge source of our happiness, and I think it's helpful for folks to kind of remember how best they can connect with others during the holiday season.
Now, you suggest there are a few keys to holiday happiness. What are those keys?
So one has to do with sort of, you know, what are the types of gifts we're giving to each other? What are we doing with other people? And emphasis on the word doing there. So some of our research finds that people tend to derive more satisfaction from what are called experiential purchases. So these would be, you know, meals out, tickets to performances, outdoor activities and recreation, than they do from material purchases like clothing and jewelry and furniture and other types of material goods that people might buy as gifts. And so if we're seeking connection with others, if we're trying to promote happiness and well-being, gifts that are more experiential in nature, money that's kind of focused on doing rather than having, tends to be a wiser investment from a psychological perspective.
Sticking with that, what's the best way to go about the you know, a gift buying strategy when you shift it? Because as you said, it more experiences can be better, but it also it would have to be something that everybody's involved with. Like if I'm a big sports fan and you're not, and I'm giving you tickets to a football game or a basketball game or a hockey game, you may not enjoy that. I mean, is you also have to like also know what is going to be best for everybody involved in the party, so to speak.
Certainly, it's helpful to take people's interests into account, but I would suspect that you know, introducing people to new experiences that they haven't encountered before might actually be beneficial as well. And so I think this gets at sort of, you know, what are some of the reasons for why this tends to be true? And one of the underlying reasons has to do with the fact that experiences kind of make for better story material than material items do. So we're more likely to talk about the football or hockey game that we went to than you know, a piece of a jewelry or a shirt that we got. And so it turns out that those social interactions are actually really important for people's happiness. And so the more that we can kind of provide fodder for people's conversations, the more likely we are to enhance their well-being.
What are some of the other keys that you suggest that people could follow to, you know, be happier for the holidays?
I think one thing that's quite important is kind of remembering sort of the importance of gratitude. Obviously, Thanksgiving has come and gone, but that doesn't mean we need to stop thinking about all that we're grateful for as other holidays approach. It turns out that when we express gratitude to other people, that makes us feel really positive as well. So it enhances our own happiness. But beyond that, I think the nature of this interaction is that we actually enhance other people's happiness as well. And in fact, our scientific studies suggest that we tend to do so more than we expect. That is, we think that we're doing something relatively inconsequential when we're expressing our appreciation to someone else. But it turns out that it's much more positive, much more meaningful for them than we anticipate.
Sticking with gratitude, obviously, I mean, it focuses on the giving aspect, because a lot of times for the holiday, sometimes people get maybe too involved in the receiving, right? And what we're going to get, what we're going to get. And this kind of gets you in a right frame of mind. But also when you express gratitude, but also, is that also could be involved, like checking in, maybe providing companionship to someone going through a hard time, maybe suffering a loss? Because that's when, for people in the holidays, that's when it really can build up on them.
Well, I think these results speak to things that we can do kind of throughout the year, but we might be especially likely to do at this particular time. Our research does suggest that what we've been discussing about gratitude is kind of broadly true about pro-social actions more generally, or other-oriented sort of, you know, warm acts that we could do for other people. Part of the sort of mistaken beliefs that people have lead to them kind of undervaluing this kind of pro-sociality, and that can keep them from engaging in behavior that would maximize both their own well-being and the well-being of others. That is, we sort of systematically underestimate or undervalue the benefits of this kind of positive social engagement. And so these are things that we could be doing a bit more often, and we likely would feel a bit better if we did them more often.
And there's a third key, right, for holiday happiness. And what is that? And can you just explain for our listeners out there how they can do better? Because I think this one might hit home for everybody here.
Yeah. So I think one thing, so broadly, I think one thing to keep in mind is that we actually want to be, you know, talking to other people rather than just kind of typing to them, sending text messages or emails or things like that, communicating through social media. It turns out that when we use our voices, we end up feeling stronger bonds with other people. Tying all of these kind of lessons together, you know, humans are really a fundamentally social species. We have a fundamental need to belong. We know that positive connections with others are really essential to our happiness. They're important for our health as well. And so thinking about what we can do to kind of enhance those connections is likely to be really important for people's well-being.
And breaking that one down to type less and talk more to people, forget just the holidays, but that's something that maybe we can look at year round, right?
Yeah, I mean, the studies that we conducted were not conducted during the holidays specifically. I think it's important to kind of keep these lessons in mind throughout the year. And so one of the concerns that people sometimes have is that it might be, you know, awkward or uncomfortable to, you know, pick up the phone and call someone. But again, it turns out that these expectations are somewhat misguided. We're kind of miscalibrated. We think it's going to be weird or uncomfortable. But in reality, it's actually not once we're actually talking to someone else. And so, again, these are things that we might hesitate to do. Maybe we're a bit more likely to do during this time of year. And I think when we actually try it, when we, you know, get on the phone and talk to somebody, for instance, that's what helps us realize that, oh, that actually felt pretty good. And so maybe we should be doing these things a bit more often.
And even with that one, you would also include FaceTime, right? I mean, you're still using a phone and that, but it's still it's still that communication, that it's not typing. So that would work, right?
Yeah, in our research, we actually kind of directly compare sort of text-based interaction to audio-only interaction, like a phone call, to audio-visual interaction, so FaceTimes or video chats or Zoom calls. It turns out that the connecting with someone over a video chat is certainly better than text-based communication, than communicating with, you know, our fingers alone. But it's really the voice that ends up being important. And so both audio-based and audio-visual communication tend to enhance our connections with others more than text alone.
Now, it appears that all of these keys can be linked together. I mean, is that is there like a common theme here with all of them?
Yeah, you know, as somebody that studies happiness scientifically, people sometimes ask, like, you know, what's the secret to happiness? And I think it isn't much of a secret at all. It's really other people. Positive social relationships with others are what matter for our well-being. When I tell people that, that's what the data suggests, and it's important to know what the data actually have to say on this. But when you tell people that, they're not super surprised or anything like that. I think what's a bit more surprising is how often we don't actually engage in these behaviors that would actually, make us better off. And so I think keeping that in mind and actually trying to incorporate these lessons into our daily lives is likely to make people feel at least a little bit better.
What would you say to somebody that might be skeptical about any of this, especially maybe that last one where, you know, typing less and talk more? Maybe they're not an outgoing person. They don't like to talk to people. They feel more comfortable texting people or emailing people. What would you say to them on how to break that shell?
I think it's important to try it. And that's what we do in our experiments. We actually, we get people's beliefs. And so they think that it might be uncomfortable or that it might not be as positive as it actually is. But when we actually, in experiments have people do this, it turns out to be better than they expect when they communicate using their voices. And so if you think about how we learn, anything, and this is a pretty broad statement, it's basically through, experience and through feedback. And so when you try it, that's when you have the opportunity to learn how it actually feels. If you're, worried about it, if you're hesitant and you say, I'll just send the text or I'll just send the email instead of talking to somebody, you'll never have the opportunity. You'll never have the chance to know what it would have been like if you had talked to them instead. And so if you give it a shot, the research suggests that you're likely to end up feeling a bit better than you expected, more connected to someone else.
Thanks to UD Lerner College of Business and Economics Assistant Professor Amit Kumar and our Joe Irizarry for enlightening us this week. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible: Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale, Joe Irizarry, Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.